KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
Now is the moment. The 2020s is the decade we knew was going to be the turning point, the inflection. This is the time to build. These are the charging 20s, the time that history will look back upon, in which we built the solar-powered civilization we all yearn for.
In this episode, visionary clean energy entrepreneur Danny Kennedy explores the promise and challenges of the epic civilizational transition to renewable energy. Without doubt, the shift has hit the fan. But will we make the transition in time to avert complete climate breakdown? Danny Kennedy says we can, and the real heroes and sheroes will be millions of clean energy entrepreneurs and startups in partnership with the determined leadership of indigenous peoples arising worldwide. I'm Neil Harvey. This is the Charging 20s. Now is the time to build a solar-powered civilization. On the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature. Energy is a nation's master resource. Each global empire has had an idiosyncratic ability to exploit a particular energy source that propelled its rise to economic power. The Dutch learned how to tap wood, wind, and water. The British Empire fueled its ascendancy on coal. The American Empire has dominated with oil. The cautionary tale is this: no empire has been able to manage the transition to the next energy source. The joker in the deck this time around is the climate imperative to fast forward the transition off fossil fuels worldwide. It requires the most complex and fiercely urgent transformation in the history of human civilization. Nothing like it has ever been done before. A new energy economy is going to require the reinvention of every aspect of our industries and lives. It's going to take visionary leaders committed to a green and fair future, who also have a deep working knowledge of technology, economy, and politics. They've got to know how to make change happen on a very large scale, all the while fighting ferocious resistance from the retrograde fossil fuel industry, desperate to delay its looming demise. One of these practical leaders is Danny Kennedy. He's currently CEO of New Energy Nexus, a cutting-edge global nonprofit platform that provides funds, accelerators, and networks to drive clean energy adoption and entrepreneurial innovation worldwide. Danny Kennedy spoke at a Bioneers conference.
And today I'm going to talk to you about the minds we need to build and the stuff we need to do to get through the energy transition that we've begun this century and the hard work and hard choices that we've got to make this decade about some tough things, including maybe some holes in the ground that need to be built, because we have to finish the job we've begun to drive the solutions of climate change. The good news is, if we do it with the sort of approach in our hearts and heads, we can create a civilization just a decade or two hence, which can actually live sustainably on this wonderful spaceship Earth forever. And that's the prospect that we have to build this decade. This is the time. We are the generation. We always knew that. And now is the time to build.
Danny Kennedy has long been at the forefront of clean energy adoption. Among many hats, he also serves as managing director of the California Clean Energy Fund, which finances early-stage companies driving innovation and building equity in the California economy. He has co-founded several clean energy companies, funds, and enterprises around the world. His earlier work, beginning in the 1990s with Greenpeace and Project Underground, put him on the front lines of stopping destructive mining and extractive projects. His activism against a gold mine in Indonesia led to his arrest, interrogation, and deportation from Papua New Guinea. He says the clock has run out for what he calls fossil fools. In fact, in 2023, for the first time ever, global investment in renewable energy surpassed investment in fossil fuels. Predictably, the backlash from this zombie industry is fast and furious.
They did damage for 200 years from extraction through pollution, and it was never going to end. We were locked in by the turn of the century, with China in particular having just begun to get its coal out of the ground to be the factory for the world, as well as to bring hundreds of millions of humans into electricity services like we take for granted in places like the US, India trying to do the same. But we realized that we had a problem, Houston. We had to decarbonize this system of electricity and mobility services that we'd become dependent on in the 20th century. We were wondering, pretty legitimately, to be honest, at the turn of the century, which technology set would we depend on for our civilization going forward? Would it be fossil fuels with carbon capture and storage? No, that's bullshit, as it turns out. Would it be a nuclear renaissance? No, it's not going to be that. Would it be wet renewables, wave power, and maybe hydro done better, run a river or something or other? As it's emerged, as the market has had its head, it's become clear we're going to be a solar-powered civilization. And the big nuclear reactor in the sky does plenty of good work, shining its lights on us every day, and we can capture it through photovoltaics and wind turbines, which the wind is transferring the heat on the Earth around. And the reason it's won the race, the question of which technology would be the winner, is simply cost. It's the lowest way to produce electricity ever in the history of the world, and we're seeing that now. And in 2014, we hit a point we call grid parity, when our electricity was cheaper than anyone else's electricity. And the thing is, the more we do it, the cheaper it gets. It's called a technology curve versus a resource curve, where a finite thing gets more expensive because it's scarce the more you use it. This stuff's getting cheaper the more we build it.
The takeaway is disarmingly simple. Fast forward the transition to renewables and electrify everything, everywhere, all at once. Of course, it's easier said than done.
Of course, there was the problem of when the wind don't shine and the sun don't, when the wind don't blow and the sun don't shine. You know the story. We had to fix for that. And so we leant into the periodic table and we did some green chemistry and we came up with the highest energy atoms that we could in lithium, a technology we'd commercialized in the 1970s for our Walkmans and made better through our personal electronics boom in the noughties. And we started putting them in cars and then on the grid. And so we solved for the problem of storage of all this abundant sunshine that comes to Earth and we can transition into electricity with these batteries that we're now making at speed and scale. And, you know, thanks to the Chinese, really, for doing that. In 2017, there was a moment where the startup BYD made the fleet of taxis and buses in the city of Shenzhen of 20 million people go electric in 1 year. And that kind of proved that batteries on wheels could store all the sunshine that they were producing in the nearby electricity markets and go from dirty to clean.
But just how renewable is renewable energy? Is it possible to have a so-called green lithium industry if it still requires endless extraction? Ironically, after starting his career opposing mining, Danny Kennedy now found himself facing the triage of climate disruption. How do we end fossil fuels and also get off the destructive extractive cycle, while we still need mining for the time being to build the clean energy future?
Here's this stuff called lithium. We thought it was only for pharmaceutical purposes until three Nobel Prize winning scientists created some batteries out of it in 71-ish. We used it for Walkmans in its first commercial application. Then around the turn of the century, some geeks down in Silicon Valley were actually wiring these little rechargeable batteries together and driving their go-kart roadsters around on them. And that became a company we now know as Tesla. And that has disrupted the automobile sector, the oil and gas industry, the grid storage and so forth, all with the incredible reality of this lithium element, which sits in the periodic table right up there with hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, right at the top very strong energy density and potential for exchange, which is why it's going to continue to be used in battery chemistries. Good news is lithium is very common in the world. In fact, in seawater, it exists at significant parts per million and is probably a future source from desalination of seawater. Right now, most of the lithium in the world comes out of hard rock mining in Australia, about 60% of it. We dig rocks up in Australia, put them on ships, take them to China, burn them in furnaces for a few weeks in a sulfuric acid bath and extract the lithium out of the rock that way. Another very big resource of lithium and a significant source of lithium in the economy today is in South America in the so-called lithium triangle of Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, where it is coming out of salt waters underground, but they evaporate it through salt ponds. So quite destructive on indigenous land in Atacama Desert. That's the other big source that's expanding in the world. The world is going to probably 10x this decade or more the need for lithium to drive all the vehicles and do all the things and electrify everything. So everyone's scrambling for new resources, new sources and reserves, trying to produce better green lithium.
But is green lithium a contradiction in terms? Here the story gets gnarly, literally.
Here we produce about 10% of California's electricity with geothermal power plants. The San Andreas Fault is squirting water out of the magma, coming up through the geological structures, dissolving everything in its path, and that all comes to the surface. And who knows what that all is. They call it a gnarly brine. That's the technical term. It's got a lot of shit in it, and it's all dissolved at super high temperatures. They've been studying it for 40 years. They've been producing this steam to the surface. It's not a lot of toxics. There are some things in there that we would be careful of in high concentration. As they bring this hot water off the San Andreas Fault to the surface to get the steam to generate the turbines, the water cools down and a whole lot of salts precipitate out of it. Lithium is one of the salts there that they can take out commercially. To take the salt out of it obviously has an environmental impact. So, I mean, I'm not saying it's without footprint. It has a footprint. The first bottles of lithium solution, which becomes lithium carbonate, lithium hydroxide, which are the precursor chemicals into the lithium battery supply chain, we have sort of all held in our hands in the last months, which is a very exciting thing because we've been talking about this since 2019 when we wrote a report called Building Lithium Valley. So we're on the cusp of green lithium with almost zero additional carbon footprint at the scale of about 300 kilotons a year, which was probably what America consumed in 2020, not what it will consume in 2030, but a good chunk of what we need. This system is such that we can extract a certain amount of this material onto the surface, into the economy, and two decades hence, we should just be cycling that. We don't need to go back to the well. We can just keep a recycling system going and use it in perpetuity, which is this wonderful, abundant, solar-powered civilization stored in lithium that we've already got in the system, if we do all this right.
Scale matters. The total amount of lithium that's necessary to mine by 2050 is a fraction of 1% compared with coal, oil, and gas. But even if lithium can be recycled at scale in a closed loop within 20 years, how do we avoid replicating the same broken economic paradigm, the extraction of concentrated wealth by giant corporations? Once again, the story gets gnarly. The California Lithium Project centers on the Salton Sea, an environmental justice calamity caused in 1904 after a dam broke and the Colorado River flooded the Imperial Valley. Today, the Salton Sea's primary water source is nearby agribusiness farm runoff, which is riddled with fertilizers, heavy metals, and toxics. It's on indigenous lands, long held sacred by tribes, in a poor, largely Latino county whose average family annual income is $13,500. And the toxic mess has resulted in a poisonous dust that's killing community members, including children. What social and economic impacts will industrial-scale lithium mining have on the 180,000 community members? Who will benefit?
One of the things that happened last year with this lithium conversation, because it's starting to get interesting from the industrial development point of view, like $4 billion of investment were announced last year. I mean, it's all paper tiger stuff. They're not real investments until they're real investments. But, you know, big battery factories are being talked about in this place. OEM, meaning automobile manufacturers, are talking about building things nearby and facilities and so forth. Billions and billions of dollars, which this town hasn't seen for a while, right? And the state legislature did impose a tax, which was hard fought. You probably didn't even hear about it in the news. But this was big deal because it says initially $400 or $700 a ton, up to $1,000 a ton will be taxed on every ton of lithium extracted from the ground and sold to be recycled into the community for community benefit. We got a lithium severance tax, effectively, written into law. There's no lithium of note being produced, so it doesn't mean anything right now, but at least there's that prospect. This tribal community has this incredible land right, which is kind of a weird twist of fate, which is they can buy 11,000 acres anywhere in this region because they had their land buried by the Salton Sea. So, you know, oh, you want to build a gigafactory, LG Chem? You need some land for that? You want that land? I can buy that land, and I'm a sovereign nation that can do whatever is necessary to do it. But the sovereign nation is smart enough to know we want to do that the best way possible.
The Torres Martinez Band of the Kaweah Indian Tribe owns 11,400 acres below the Salton Sea, with rights to purchase 11,500 adjacent acres. Rather than leasing the valuable development rights that will pipeline the profits to corporate headquarters, the tribe is organizing itself as a sovereign nation to reinvent the tribal business economy through its own ownership, development, and entrepreneurship. While protecting its cultural and natural assets, including its language and history, the tribe is designing sustainable development plans, including youth entrepreneurial accelerators. Jesus Arguelles, a business consultant to the Torres Martinez Band, calls it servant capitalism, intended to create an eco-industrial zone, providing good jobs and an inclusive economy. Needless to say, there are serious issues and concerns. Many native people are justifiably skeptical of any kind of commercial mining, whose long history of environmental racism and eco-apartheid is well documented. There are also environmental unknowns. Disturbing the deep, briny watershed could provoke earthquakes, although there's been marginal such increase from the existing hydropower plants, at least so far. The historical echoes of false promises by techno-utopians and the imperious greed of corporate interests resound throughout the community. Yet at the same time, climate breakdown necessitates the imperative for large-scale action. Welcome to 21st Century Triage. When we return, how California is setting the pace for the clean energy revolution and a just transition that elevates those who've been hurt first and worst by petro-colonial legacies, how China and India are electrifying, and how millions of clean energy entrepreneurs may be the heroes and sheroes of this epic transition. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers. You can visit bioneers.org to subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts. Check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most and learn about our conferences. That's bioneers.org. How fast the massive clean energy transition happens remains a wild card. But some things are certain. The fossil fuel industry will use every trick in its playbook to obstruct the decarbonization of the economy, and big business will do anything and everything to prevent the democratization of the economy. Again, Danny Kennedy.
I see two big psyops in the sort of media and messaging war that's out there. One is saying that it's sort of a apples and apples experience. What aboutism? You know, this transition to clean energy is going to do just as much destruction, so don't worry about it, just hang out with fossil fuels. It's sort of false equivalency that the mining required for lithium batteries, for example, is just as bad as fossil fuels. The other is that the startups and the innovators and the disruptors and the community activists and the organizers that are trying to build community wealth through this transition because of the innate justice built into a distributed energy architecture that could be locally owned and democratically controlled, they can't deliver it on time. You've got to depend on the big guys. It's almost like this is a track, a script that's been put into the executive offices of these oil companies over the last few years. They're repeating and repeating this message, partly to spread fear, uncertainty, and doubt, which has been their game for 30, 40 years, but also just in case they want to try to capture the initiative and take the market and do the next century just as they've dominated the last.
As the fifth largest economy in the world, California is on a path to 100% renewable energy and a decarbonized economy by 2045. By 2023, it had already reached 31% renewable energy, up from about 4% just a decade earlier. Can California's ambitious trajectory go national and global? Given that we're already in climate overtime, can we quicken the pace? Danny Kennedy says the kinds of entrepreneurship and startups that New Energy Nexus supports are crucial.
And so here we are in the 2020s. We've got to just electrify everything. There's a billion machines here in the States that have to be switched over from thermal system to electric, and 10 billion systems around the world. We're obviously going too slow, and we need to speed this up. California, 2035, not 2045. Come on, people. We've got to build some new muscles. We really have to do things differently, including build stuff. We've got to go back to the future, really, and the indigenous wisdom and the leadership of communities of color, the people who have been hurt first and worst, those living with the legacies of fossil fuels that are actually leading the way. The lift we have to do this decade, we're less than half of our economy electric right now, and that's a big lift. We've built a lot of renewables that we can't interconnect to the grid because of transmission delays and pipelines and things. Where we are seeing leadership for this in the States, I could talk about, you know, the amazing people in Standing Rock that are standing up wind farms as well, or the Yurok up in Northern California that have built out the resilience microgrid at Blue Lake Rancheria and are helping the offshore wind industry grow out of Humboldt Bay. But we've supported startups in Navajo, which are just doing incredible things, leveraging the reality that as coal crashed during the Trump years there, they were left with these stranded assets of high voltage transmission cables to Vegas, Phoenix, and LA. And they've decided to build community wealth by building massive solar projects on their own country, owned and led by Navajo people themselves, which will sell electricity to market. And along the way, they've built Navajo Power Home, which is actually electrifying the 15,000 families on the reservation that were left without electricity at the end of the 20th century, which is a disgusting shame on America's record. But I have the privilege of working with 150 amazing folk around the world supporting startups in many countries to get this energy transition done. We support diverse entrepreneurs with justice and equity in, so we get justice and equity out of this transformation. We've had 880 companies come up since I joined the outfit in 2016. We've supported thousands of entrepreneurs, put $50 million into them, and we're trying to redress the gender injustice that's inherent in the energy industry, as well as in the startup scene more generally, with some success, although always more work to do. And we're seeing this upswelling, this Cambrian explosion of this opportunity that is actually happening in real time in the world.
Addressing climate disruption is intrinsically a global game. No country can do it alone. In particular, China and India are make-it-or-break-it players. Just on rooftops, China is supplying 50 gigawatts of solar annually, the energy equivalent of what 15 nuclear power plants produce in 1 year. It's also still burning gobs of coal and building coal plants. Meanwhile, India has adopted a potentially game-changing national solar mission. It's playing out in unexpected places, where it really counts.
Just like 5 years ago, India was being talked about as this ticking time bomb on climate because they're going to get electricity for all their people. And now they're doing it with solar and wind at a scale and speed which is almost hard to imagine. And that is spilling over into their mobility markets, where vehicle miles traveled in India are mostly on 2- and 3-wheel vehicles. You know, think the rickshaws in Delhi or the mopeds in Mumbai. 85% of people get around that way. And that is all electrifying because this low cost, abundant electricity is spilling out of the system and charging batteries all over the market. And that is actually destroying demand for oil in the world. Like millions of barrels a day is actually being reduced from global demand by the electrification of mobility. And we're seeing this everywhere. In Indonesia, we've got a company in our portfolio that's doing it for hot swappable batteries for the two-wheelers there. We've got a company that actually came up in Berkeley, California called PowerHive that is taking Boda Bodas electric in East Africa. Boda Bodas are like the taxis in Kenya that they've got hot swappable battery platforms for.
Similar kinds of radical shifts are now disrupting marine transportation. Hundreds of millions of humans move around rivers and coasts in small gas-powered, emissions-belching boats that are now starting to go electric too, and it's much cheaper. One challenge to meet the needs of the transition is the lack of a U.S. manufacturing base. Another is the dearth of training for the people and skills needed, as well as practical support for small businesses. Now, says Danny Kennedy, is the time to unite to build a solar-powered civilization.
We literally need millions of businesses to deliver the electric everything, the appliances, the induction stoves in the houses, the marine transportation mechanic shops to switch out the motors or whatever. You know, like, there's not enough getting into that game, and then there's not enough workers to work in those workforces. You know, like, just electricians to electrify everything, you need electricians. You know, we're short at least 100,000 in the United States for what we think we need done. The rest of the world, forget about it. And this, I think, is actually the big one. It's geopolitics. We are talking about them and us, and we're creating a desire to dominate these supply chains and these industries instead of, we are all in this together, we must collaborate, we have one decade to do this, people. And we cannot fall out. You know, the saber rattling is frightening to me. And I'm not, you know, pretending the Chinese are above this at all either. But we need to get together and not let the scarcity mindset of the past and these men and their toys and the military industrial complex and their businesses drag us and our children into a distraction rather than do the work that needs done this decade. Now is the moment. The 2020s is the decade we knew was going to be the turning point, the inflection. We are on the path. We must stay the course. Do not get distracted. This is the time to build. These are the charging 20s, the time that history will look back upon in which we built the solar-powered civilization we all yearn for. Shine on.
Danny Kennedy, shining on. The charging 20s. Now is the time to build a solar-powered civilization. Executive producer Kenny Ausubel. Written by Kenny Ausubel. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. Producer, Teo Grossman. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 266.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
Playing cards are thought to have their origins in China over 1,000 years ago. And the classic 52-card deck we know today, with Ace to Ten and Jack, Queen, King, are a largely French version from the 17th century. The humble deck of cards is deeply ingrained in our social fabric. It gives us common sayings about having to play the cards you are dealt, the deck being stacked against you, or someone not being the full deck. You gotta know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, sings Kenny Rogers. Christa Berg's Spanish Train tells of the Lord and the Devil playing cards for souls of the dead. This is a familiar scenario in folklore from around the world, when people play cards with a stranger who turns out to be the devil, revealed by a cloven foot under a table. It never ends well. Religions have railed against playing cards, as a person's fate should not come down to games of chance, but to higher callings. And there is mystery too as to the deeper symbolism of the deck of cards. Many believe it's based on the calendar. There are 4 suits for 4 seasons, 13 cards in each suit matching the lunar cycle, 52 cards for 52 weeks, and if you add up the values of all the cards, plus the Joker, you get 365. Some say this is coincidence. I think not. I mean, what are the odds? Cards have been part of my life since I was 9, when my granddad taught me to play poker and do a dovetail shuffle before dealing. The time I played most was when I was much older and was in 6th year, and my mates Stephen, Ferdia, Paul B, Paul H, Johnny, Michael and I had regular poker sessions. We'd meet in someone's house, our bikes parked around back, have a couple of beers and play for usually modest amounts. Well, there was a comfortable familiarity to these nights, with their own rituals, slagging and banter, our individual fortunes were always moving and shifting. One particular night stands out for me. It was when I cleaned everyone out. No matter who dealt that night, good hands just kept coming, and when they didn't, I either folded in good time, heeding Kenny Rogers' advice, or bluffed like Clint Eastwood or James Bond. At the end of the night, I neatly piled columns of coins in front of me, like the miser Silas Marner in George Eliot's novel, which we were then reading for the Leaving Cert, and counted up the considerable sum of £36. The next morning, I put my hoard in a plastic Quinsworth shopping bag, went to the bookshop on the top floor of Dunleary's shopping centre, scoured the shelves, and picked out 6 books. I'd never gone on a book-buying spree like that before, and never have since, but I knew that's what I wanted to spend the winnings on. I brought my 6 books to the till, put them on the counter, took out my bag and poured out the coins. The bookseller said, dryly, "Poker session?" I can't remember all the titles now, but I do know that one of those books was James Joll's History of Europe since 1870, with portraits on the cover of a host of people that helped define Europe: Karl Marx, Albert Einstein, Queen Victoria, Charles de Gaulle. I remember how struck I was when I first sat down to read it by the clarity of its language and argument. Complex topics were teased out in lucid prose that made sense of a past world while I was trying to make sense of my own. It showed me what history could be like. I loved that book, and still do. I pick it up periodically and flick through its pages, which have passages underlined with a ruler and 18-year-old's comments in the margins. It is a central place in the sitting room, a sort of father figure to the rest of the books on my shelves. Without me, all you others might not be here. Before that poker session, I'd bought books, but not many. I wasn't really a reader then, or any kind of bookish person. But the morning after that poker session, spending that £36 on books was more important to me than buying records, clothes, or pints on a couple of nights out. I sometimes wonder how things might have worked out if I hadn't bought those books. Maybe the shelves around our house would not be bending under the weight of books. And maybe I'd never have gone on to write my own books or pieces for the radio. Or maybe I would. Maybe it all would have happened anyway, just at another time. But I've learned that in history, nothing is inevitable. There are always particular circumstances required for a seismic change to happen. And maybe mine was a poker session with the lads around a kitchen table on a night when the cards just fell right for me.
On a warm summer's evening, on a train bound for nowhere, I met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep, so we took turns of staring out the window at the darkness. The boredom overtook us, and he began to speak. He said, "Son, I've made a life out of reading."
Let's start with a trigger warning. I went to the dentist this week and it was bad. I needed to have a tooth pulled out. It was a molar that had been troublesome for a while, thanks to a small stone in a salad months before, which had managed to crack not the crown that sat over the remaining remnant of tooth, but the remnant itself. The crack was in the root. When I arrived and slid into that big chair, the dentist said he was going to break the crown in half and remove each root at a time, as though he couldn't care less. Then he was over me with a great needle, and I closed my eyes, telling myself the needle was the worst bit, although I had never had a tooth cracked in two and pulled out in pieces, so I couldn't really say. He came back with more needles, and each time he did, the semi-darkness behind my eyelids that the great lamp over the chair was illuminating became a full dark. And on the third needle, when the dark came, a huge and sudden force pushed outwards from my chest, battering at my ribs, so I was amazed the dentist wasn't forced back by it. I realised it was my heartbeat, and that I was on the verge of a panic attack, a first ever panic attack, and I thought, that's it. I'm turning into my mother. I'm going to bite the dentist. That's what Mum did, if you'll believe it. This was years ago, and a different dentist. She was so terrified that she bit down hard on his finger, so hard she made him bleed, and he told her not to come back. Mum had needed many teeth pulled when she was young, and in those days you were held down and there was no anaesthetic, and ever since she had had a terror of dentists that her lifelong problem teeth had ingrained. That day, the day she bit the dentist, something strange happened to her. She wasn't the polite Tunbridge Wells comes to Belfast version of herself that I knew. She did something that was primitive and feral and wholly protective of herself, something wild and violent. Do we all have that button somewhere, buried in us? I did not inherit Mum's fear of dentists, but I dislike sitting in that big chair under that big lamp, and who doesn't? The week before my appointment, I'd held a grim humour about things, muttering to myself that the long trudge towards old crone continued. I decided that because I could joke, it must not really bother me, which is why it was such a surprise when it did. When the dentist and the dark came for a fourth time, I couldn't tell whether I would scream or vomit or follow the maternal line and attack him. But I could not feel the needle. The numbness was beginning to spread. My heart calmed. I noticed that my hands were crossed in my lap and that my feet also were crossed politely. I was holding myself in. I felt sure that if I didn't, my body would melt onto the floor and nothing would be left on that big chair except my teeth. The dentist began to chip at the crown. Then the drill came out. A deep ache had developed in my jaw, and I wondered, did Mum know she was going to bite the dentist right before she did? I complained about the ache, and the dentist gave me a piece of black rubber to bite down on. The pain eased. He continued to drill, and I bit away to my heart's content. We both waited for the crack. Before it came, I had a strange flash of sentimentality for the tooth that had been part of me for over 30 years that I was about to lose. There was a crunching noise, his drill jumped, and I could feel something sitting on my tongue, something the suction tube quickly sucked away. Various metal tools were attempted one by one on the tooth. I had no idea what the dentist was doing, and the worst of it was, I knew he must be pulling, but what I felt in my deeply numbed jaw was that he was pushing down hard. For a second time, a terror flooded me of the noise the tooth would make at the pull. When it came, in the end, there was no noise. I paid the receptionist £100 and went to sit in the bathroom. There was a smudge of blood on my chin, and I felt a sudden childlike need to cry. There was only one person I could call. Hey, Mum, are you free to talk?
Tucked in just off Bridgefoot Street in Dublin's Liberties, a battered old green street sign high on a stone wall bears the name Marshalsea Lane, a street that no longer exists. It is also the only indication that these walls are the last remnants of the Four Courts Marshalsea, Ireland's principal debtor's prison, which moved to this location in 1777. These surviving walls belonged to a paved courtyard where the inmates of the prison would while away their endless days playing various ball games. The Marshalsea held debtors whose cases had come before the Court of King's or Queen's Bench. For much of the 18th and 19th centuries, those who couldn't pay their debts could be incarcerated at the behest of their creditors. Although not classed as criminals, they were held as prisoners until their debts were either paid or forgiven. While the threat of ending up in a debtor's prison existed for rich and poor alike, their experience there varied dramatically according to their means. In the Four Courts Marshalsea, master or gentleman debtors could rent rooms which were located in the upper yard of the complex. As the name suggests, the vast majority of these master debtors were men, but there were lady debtors also. The lower yard was used by debtors who couldn't afford to pay for rooms but who could cover their own subsistence. It also housed the third group, the pauper debtors, who were completely dependent on government support. The prison authorities were anxious to keep the inmates of the upper and lower yard segregated, an aspiration which was frustrated by the fact that the gentlemen debtors had to pass through the lower yard to reach their ball court. In his memoir, St. Catherine's Bells, the Dublin merchant Walter Thomas Mailer gives an account of a series of business setbacks that led to him spending some months as a prisoner for debt in the Four Courts Marshalsea during the early 1840s. He describes his fellow gentlemen debtors as an odd assortment of spendthrifts, rogues, and people who'd simply been unlucky in their financial affairs. Mailer had a generous allowance from his family and fitted out his rooms with shelves full of books, a bagatelle table, and what he describes as all the necessaries for a bachelor's household. He also engaged a woman named Margaret Nolan to act as his housekeeper during his stay. He passed much of his time in the ball court playing rackets, a game similar to squash which originally developed in debtors' prisons in London in the 18th century. The ball court seems to have been the centre of social life in the Marshalsea, and it contained a gallery where prisoners and outside visitors could watch matches. Mailer wrote that, wishing to make himself at home in his new community, he purchased a racket and balls and learned to become adept at the game. He said he joined in most matches and continued playing about 4 hours a day. While the ball court was usually a source of great conviviality within the Marshalsea, an altercation one afternoon between Mailer and another prisoner named Michael Staunton almost proved fatal. Michael Staunton was the mixed-race son of a Captain Staunton who had been engaged in the West Indian sugar trade. He was left a large fortune by his father, but according to Mailer, never called stop until he dissipated away all his money and he eventually found himself in debtor's prison. On the afternoon in question, Staunton accused Mailer and his companions of monopolising the court in contravention of the agreed customs of the prison. A large group of prisoners and visitors in the observation gallery witnessed Mailer's response, in which he called Staunton a liar. Staunton reacted by attacking Mailer, grabbing him in what Mailer described as a bear hug. Mailer shook Staunton off and challenged him to a duel in the Marshalsea's upper yard, apparently one of the necessaries of the bachelor's household, which he had brought with him was a pair of duelling pistols. On hearing the melee, Bat Sullivan, an older and much beloved long-term resident of the Marshalsea, intervened. Following some negotiations, both Staunton and Mailer agreed to withdraw their intemperate remarks. Bat Sullivan then mentioned that he had been sent in a beautiful, fresh turbot fish that very day and insisted that the former belligerents join him and some of the other prisoners that evening for dinner. Sullivan also sent out an invitation to his wife, daughters and some other ladies to visit the prison that evening and join the party. One of the prisoners played the violin and Staunton's rooms, which were located opposite Sullivan's, were thrown open for a dance. The party didn't break up until daylight, and among the guests was Joseph Dennis Mullen, the genial governor of the Marshalsea. The Forecourt's Marshalsea closed in 1874. For a while, the building served as a barracks for the Dublin militia, before later becoming a warren of tenements. It was demolished in the 1970s, with the exception of the ball court, which survives, along with memories of hard-fought games and hot-headed players.
Of an Irishman never been speaker, when war is a story or love is a theme, and place him where bullets fly thicker and thicker, you'll find him all poverty storming. And though a motion made for Derby light up the heart he rallies on, fortune is cruel but not a
In 1989, I began what could be called my independent life, and I moved into my first bedsit, a small single room in an old, crumbling Georgian house. It must have been a maid's room originally. The width of the room was little more than one person's outstretched arms. It was obvious from the tiny fireplace, which incidentally was the only source of heat, that a servant's comfort wasn't exactly a top priority 200 years ago. My new home boasted a single cold tap and a gas meter, which you had to keep well fed with 50 pence pieces if you didn't want the gas to cut out in the middle of cooking your dinner, a nice line of damp running down the corner of the wall behind the bed, a shower in the basement and a bath in the attic, two toilets for the whole house, shared among eight other flats, a public phone in the hall, and, finally, a carpet and wallpaper pattern so shocking that even looking at it for too long could induce a dizzy spell. Being a young freelance actor, I lived more or less hand-to-mouth. The weekly food shop was supplemented by monthly butter vouchers. I collected the fuel allowance each Tuesday, out of which I had to buy a week's briquettes. However, you couldn't light the fire before midday, as the grate was too small to keep it burning freely for more than 5 or 6 hours. If you wanted to keep the room warm on winter evenings, you had to let the fire go out and wait for the grate to cool, then lay and light the fire all over again. The alternative was to go to bed at tea time with a hot water bottle, something which I occasionally did. The luxury of a television was way beyond what I could afford in those days, not to mention the license that went with it. But I did manage to acquire a small second-hand black-and-white portable for two-channel viewing from a kind friend. This TV was so small I could fit it into my oven, which is exactly what I did whenever the TV license inspectors called around. Whenever my doorbell rang after 6 p.m, I'd just automatically unplug the television and pop it in the oven before letting them in. Unusually enough, the landlords lived on the premises. They were an elderly couple from the country and a little eccentric, but very kind and caring. Once I returned from being away to find that my landlord had replaced my plain cream curtains with orange and brown patterned ones. This was his gift to me. These curtains assaulted my senses like a sledgehammer, but the landlord's anticipation of my pleasure was so immense I hadn't the heart to crush him. As soon as he left, I burst into tears. Now the only place left for me to rest my eyes was the back of the white-painted door. Remembering that couple and their many kindnesses, I realized they were never less than well-intentioned. I often thought some of their tenants took the place of the children they never had. The rest of the house's inhabitants consisted of an odd collection of souls. One of my more vulnerable neighbors kept a snorkel beside the bath. I'm not quite sure what role this piece of equipment played in her nightly routine, but I never asked. In time, some well-intentioned civil servants and politicians decided that shared bathrooms were unacceptable and bedsits had to go. Unfortunately, any semblance of affordable rent seemed to go along with them. While in no way wishing to romanticize the borderline squalor of some of these places, the fact was that I could afford to live in peace in my little bedsit, and with careful management of my small income, remain debt-free. The bedsit gave way to the studio, which is a bedsit in all but name, only without the advantage of affordability and access. Renting in the years that followed brought unimaginable levels of stress and insecurity. But even worse is thinking of the many young adults today who will spend their 20s, 30s, and possibly beyond trapped in their childhood bedroom. I look back fondly on those 5 years in that bedsit out of which I made a home. I think of the little grate, the psychedelic curtains, the telly in the oven. And I just remember being so happy.
It's amazing how we Irish turn up everywhere in history, and no place more so than in France. Saint Fiacre of the early Irish Celtic Church left his hermitage in Kilkenny and turned up in Broye, France, and became famous as a herbalist. He died there in 670. He's the patron saint of gardeners, and his relics are venerated in Meaux Cathedral in northern France. Meaux was a great centre of devotion to Saint Fiacre, especially during the 17th and 18th centuries. He had a reputation, believe it or not, for healing hemorrhoids, known as Saint Fiacre's figs. Queen Anne of Austria visited his shrine and praised him for curing her husband. Cardinal Richelieu also visited, hoping for a cure. The saint also gave his name to the horse-drawn carriages called fiacres that could be hired at Hotel Saint Fiacre in the Rue Saint-Martin in Paris. As a result, he is also the unofficial patron saint of taxi drivers. As you travel around France, you will find many streets and squares named after Saint Fiacre. The French might be speaking Dutch now, if not for the Irish Brigade's attack at the crucial 1745 Battle of Fontenoy. They saved the day by their surprise charge out from the woods when things were going very badly for the French. The fight was against an alliance of the Dutch, Hanoverians, and English, commanded by the Duke of Cumberland. The Irish Brigade's hurrah as they charged was, "Remember Limerick," to recall the Treaty of Limerick and the subsequent bad faith of the Williamite English forces. In the following century, a Fenian rallying cry was, "Remember Fontenoy." It is today a small village on the French-Belgian border where you can see a fine Celtic cross put there in 1907 and a plaque installed by Irish Americans from San Francisco who were also remembering Fontenoy. Around the same time as the Battle of Fontenoy, a young émigré Irish doctor, Jean-Baptiste MacMahon from Limerick, arrived in Vézelay, Burgundy, to treat an elderly Count Moray. The patient eventually died, but his young wife, Charlotte, had taken a fancy to the young Irish doctor and married MacMahon, who thus became extremely rich. His grandson, General Patrice MacMahon, became president of the Third French Republic in 1872. His descendants continue to live in the Chateau de Souilly near Autun in Burgundy. It's open to the public. Vézelay was also where many French artists lived in the early 20th century. Before Picasso and his circle turned to the south of France, Vézelay, 2 hours train ride from Paris, was where it was at. Christian Zervos, who was a great patron of the arts and publisher of the Cahiers des Arts, also lived there. He encouraged artists and bought their paintings. He hired Jean Badovici and his Irish partner, architect Eileen Gray from Wexford, to redesign and renovate his farmhouse La Goulotte on the outskirts of Vézelay. Badovici and Eileen went on to renovate 3 other houses in Vézelay before moving south to the Cap Martin, where they built the famous modernist E1027 villa. W.B. Yeats died just around the corner in Roquebrune in 1939, the same year that Corbusier was painting dubious murals on the interior walls of Eileen's villa. So, following on that great Hiberno-French tradition of integration, I lived for a while in a small village not far from Vézelay. Feeling the need to better integrate, I asked to speak at a seminar of the local Dry Stone, Pierre Seiche, society. I knew a bit about dry stone walls in Ireland, as anyone who travels to the west of Ireland will do. In the town hall of Avalon, I got up to speak about the dry stone building tradition in Ireland. I started, as you do, with the Cade of Fields, dwelled a lot on the early Irish church buildings such as Galeris Oratory and Skellig Michael, and went on up to the arrival of the Normans and then the current stone walls. I noticed a particularly animated person in the front row, and when question time came, he stood up and asked in French if I knew a certain Professor Harbison of the Royal Irish Academy and a paper he had published in 1972 casting doubt on the early date for Galeris and intimating that there are traces of mortar in the oratory if you look hard enough, not dry stones. This French scholar then went on to claim that the beehive huts on Skellig Michael were in fact built in the 19th century to store gunpowder and for shelter when the lighthouse was being built. It turned out that he also has a website that casts doubt on the early Irish church and the myths surrounding it. I countered by mentioning San Fiacre as an aspect of the early Irish church we could surely all agree on. The scholar got even more hot under the collar. "Don't get me started," he said. Sometimes it's hard to separate myth from reality, but at least look out for Fiacre next time you're in France.
Young man looks at me, somewhat bewildered. "The Great Gatsby," I repeat. "By F. Scott Fitzgerald." Still the blank gaze. And it's then that the woman on my side of the counter steps in to help. One stream of Mandarin later, and before I know it, the male shop assistant is out like a greyhound from behind the bookshop counter, has picked up a stepladder, and is propping it up against a wall of books that climbs so high that it actually hurts my neck to peer to the top. 1 minute later, and the young man descends, grinning triumphantly and waving the green-covered paperback book in his hand in my direction. The Great Gatsby it is, in Chinese. It's September 2018 and I'm in Beijing and determined to feed my obsession by adding to my already sizable collection of different editions of Fitzgerald's masterpiece. How much of an obsession? Well, the current count now stands at 28. Yes, 28 different copies of F. Scott Fitzgerald's third novel are currently residing side by side on one very long bookcase shelf. Among those are the book from Beijing, two Italian editions, one bought in Sicily and the other in Rome, a French version, Gatsby Le Magnifique, purchased in Nice, El Gran Gatsby, bought in Madrid, and then there's my unpronounceable, to me at least, Greek version, procured a few years ago from the somewhat bemused owner of a little bookshop in the former Cretan capital of Hania. The other 22 are all in English, from various publishers, in various sizes, and with various types of cover. From a beautiful hardback Penguin Classic edition, all elegance and decorative gold swirls, to a garish Pulp the Classics edition, complete with artwork depicting a